This is American Dreamers. My name is Claire Clotty, and every week together with Aura Studios, we'll be sharing fascinating stories and conversations with Black Brits or Black Americans living the American dream or aspiring to live the American dream outside of the US. If you haven't heard the saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I suggest you Google it because it will give you some context for this episode of American Dreamers. Speaking with global citizen Joanne Griffith, an internationally renowned journalist, digital strategist, creative leader, and a self-confessed audiophile, my kind of people, we'll be hearing why she moved to the US when she already had a good thing going on in the UK. Welcome, Joanne. How are you?
Hi, Claire. It's so good to actually finally kind of, you know, we've talked a few times, but actually kind of, although I guess this is radio, so you won't see it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, this is the first time we're seeing each other.
It's the first time we're seeing each other, yeah. So it's lovely. Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me on.
You were well established as a radio journalist in the UK. How did you get there?
I had always wanted to, like, actually radio wasn't on my radar at all. If I did any kind of journalism at all, I always wanted to do print. I went through a phase for a while that I wanted to be a physiotherapist. Of course, when I was really young, I wanted to be an astronaut. Still hold aspirations on the astronaut front. I'm not kind of letting that go. You know, hey, you never know. JPL is down the street from where I live in California. Awesome. So you never know. But, you know, when I was introduced to radio, I was like, oh yeah, this is 100% me. You know, it's all about telling stories. It's all about connecting with the audience. It's all of those kind of things. And so I worked my way up like so many of us do. I did a postgraduate diploma in broadcast journalism at the University of Westminster, which actually wasn't meant to happen. I'd finished university. I was working in the technical support department at Volkswagen in Milton Keynes. And like, I went for lunch one day and I bought a copy of The Voice newspaper. And in that, you know, you kind of flick through and, you know, read the stories. And for some reason, I kind of got to the back of the newspaper and there was this ad for the broadcast journalism course at the University of Westminster. So I went home and I said to my parents, I was like, so I got offered a place on this broadcast journalism postgraduate thing. Can I have some money? Because I didn't have any money. And I am the child of immigrants. So I was like, there's no way they're giving me £2,500 to do this postgrad course. Like, there's no way. And my mum was like, yeah, sure. I'm like, I'll go to the bank and I'll get it for you. I was like, oh.
Hello, excuse me, mum. Did you just hear what I said? £2,500?
Oh, no, I didn't ask a question. But she did make the point. She said, by the way, I'm not giving this to you. This is a loan. So you have to pay me
back. Yeah, I understand that.
I was like, that's fair. So yeah, so I finished my job at Volkswagen and I started at the University of Westminster on this postgrad course a few days later. And it really opened the doors truly to my career. You know, I used to volunteer on a weekend show called Black Mix. Terrible name, great show. And I did that for a while. And then it was like the 1997 election when Tony Blair became prime minister and they'd asked me to come in and do some stuff then. And it was a big deal because I went from working on weekends to working on dayside or daytime. And then I kind of just stayed and worked on different shows. It was a news and talk station. So it was a lot of call in. I did some reporting. I did producing. Princess Diana died. So I planned a lot of special coverage around that. And really that's where my career began.
At the time, and arguably still now, the BBC is a big deal, and you had your foot in the door. In fact, 2 feet underneath the desk, meaning that you were ahead of the game, especially for an ethnic minority journalist. What would you say the culture and environment was like for Black British journalists at the time?
So the contingent of Black folks at the station all worked on that show, on Black Mix, a grand total of 3 of us. So working on dayside, it was me and then one of the news editors. Randomly, her dad was my teacher at school, but they were from Sri Lanka, so they were the kind of Indian heritage. And that was it. And anyone who is a person of color or a child of immigrants in the UK or even here in the US know this refrain, which is you've got to work twice as hard to get half as far. And I remember when I kind of got that opportunity to work on Dayside, literally every day I went in and that was the refrain that was in my head, because there was nobody else. It was just me. And my parents had always made a point of saying to me, like, speak properly. It's Luton, not Luton.
Luton.
Yeah, Luton. 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 So there was real code switching. You know, I'd talk in my Luton accent when I was with my friends. But when I was at work, I was talking like this and making sure that every single letter was enunciated, because A, I knew that I wasn't going to get a pass like everybody else would. And also my mum and dad could hear. And I knew that I'd be in trouble
as soon as you walked through the front door.
Yeah, if I was not speaking properly. Like, you know, and anyone who has parents from the Caribbean will know this. Our parents say all kind of things in all kind of ways. But the letter H is the one that everyone says H. And there used to be a store, and actually there might still be, called W.H. Smith. And it was in the news for some reason. And I called it W.H. Smith. And I came out of the news booth because I was reading the news, and this producer was kind of like, that's wrong. It's H, not H. And I remember feeling like so embarrassed and so like, oh my gosh, like I have no business being on the radio when I don't know the difference between H and H. But you say what you hear. And that's sure. what I would hear in my household. So there was a lot of dealing with those kind of things, not just at my first station, but many stations.
So whilst you were experiencing that, you know, internally, externally, you look like you're living the dream. I mean, you're young, you've got a great job, you've got great family support, you're building your life outside of the workplace, you know, you're a homeowner, and things seem to be going well, would you say?
I mean, I think I was very fortunate in my career, and I still feel that way, that sometimes doors are opened and I'm like, why is this door being opened for me? Why am I getting these particular opportunities? Like, I'm no different from anybody else. And yet these things would happen. A lot of it was hard work, but I'm a woman of faith. I call it God too, because I have no business doing some of the stuff that I've done, like none. I ended up as a newscaster on Five Live. You know, I used to listen to Five Live as a kid, and there I was hosting the morning show, or, you know, reading the news into Victoria Derbyshire, or sitting next to Rod Sharp. You know, he was the guy who started Up All Night, and I loved that show. And there was me kind of sitting there reading his news. You know, I got to travel to Barbados to do stories. I went to Malawi to travel to do stories. And I'm like, is this my life? Like, how am I this kid from Luton with parents from Barbados getting to do all of this work and meaningful work and being an example to kind of other young Black girls who might think, oh, wow, like, I want to work in journalism, or I want to work in radio. And I was kind of like, well, you can do it because I'm doing it. I was always grateful for those opportunities, but it made it even harder than when I made the decision to leave the UK, because it wasn't just about me. It was, well, there aren't, at the time, there weren't too many people like me who were reading the news on a national outlet every day. And there's a weight and a responsibility that comes with that.
Before you decided to move to the US, what were your assumptions about the US and American people? And did they live up to, you know, your stereotypes or perceptions of America?
Well, I actually studied American studies as part of my undergrad. So I did American studies and politics. And a part of that, I actually spent a semester in Arizona, of all places. And so I think some of my preconceptions of America and what it was like kind of got knocked into touch during that trip. You know, I remember saying to my parents, oh yeah, like, I'm going to LA. And they were like, LA is so violent. There's guns and there's gangs and there's drugs. Don't talk to anybody. Da, 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 da. And of course, like, we all came, and I was like, downtown LA, you know, a whole group of us, again, no business doing that, but we did. And it wasn't anything like that. We met really great people, saw really great things. And I think for me, that was the trip that probably really piqued my interest in the US. I really saw possibility in a way that I didn't at home. I saw a way that, as a Black woman, that I could have a different life. But I didn't have any idea of how I would do it. It felt like something I was like, oh yeah, that would be really cool. But I didn't honestly ever think that it's something that would happen. I didn't have a plan for it. It kind of just happened.
So as a Black woman, did you identify with what you thought it meant to be Black in America and have those opportunities?
It was not an easy transition, but there was a lot that I had in common with other Black women. Until you open your mouth, you're just a Black woman.
Sure.
Right? And so there's everything that comes with that. There's the assumptions about who you are, how you act, what your belief system might be, how angry you might be about any particular thing, just all of those things, how you carry yourself, how you should wear your hair, all of those things. And so I definitely remember having a lot of conversations with my Black female friends about just what it meant to walk in this skin as a woman, you know, how you are perceived walking into a room without saying a word, how you have to kind of hold yourself and not be quick to anger, because perception is everything, you know. So not even having anyone, even for a millisecond, believe that you're angry about something, because then you're the angry Black woman. So it was that whole thing. And it was the same in the UK. You know, there were a lot of things that I was unhappy with in the workplace. I remember at one station when I had a contract, the contract came to an end. I wasn't rehired when other people who had started with me were hired. They did not look like me. And I remember kind of being really upset by that. And I had someone who, at the time, I deemed a friend, you know, we're not friends now, but this person pulled me aside and it was kind of like, you know, you have to not be so angry. Like, don't be so angry. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't have a job. And the reasons I don't have a job are kind of bogus. And it was like, yeah, but you know, but you really can come across as really angry sometimes. And to her credit, she thought that she was doing me a favor, but I was like, I was angry at her perception that I was angry. I'm like, I'm not angry. I'm just trying to do my job. I'm just trying to work. And you know, when I came out here, I have friends out here who'd experienced exactly the same thing. I will say, being out here in the US, I think my accent confuses people. It's like a disarming technique. As soon as you open your mouth and they hear that you're British, they're so confused about who they thought you were before you opened your mouth. And then you opened your mouth and now it's like, cannot compute. And then it just shuts down and they just leave you alone.
That definitely resonates. You know, I've got dreadlocks and I'm a Black woman. And when I present, there are so many, you know, assumptions about who I am before I've even opened my mouth. And they hear the British accent and I can almost physically see people relax and get warm and open. And, you know, they haven't opened their arms, but I can see them wanting to give me a hug and tell me their life story.
Exactly right.
And it's bizarre. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to use that to my advantage if I can, but it's not something that I'm accustomed to in the UK.
I got out of a jaywalking ticket. I was out walking with my husband. This is when I first moved here. And, you know, like, you walk wherever you want in the UK. No one's really going to say anything. But we jaywalked because we were trying to get somewhere as hot and just about to get to the other side of the road. And we see this police car roll up. And my husband, quick as a flash, and my husband is Black, by the way, he was kind of like, you do all the talking. I was like, what do you mean? He was like, you do the talking. So I was like, all right, fine. So the officer's kind of like, oh, excuse me, you realize that you were jaywalking. And I let him talk. I didn't say anything. I let him talk. And then I was like, oh, Mr. Officer, I'm so sorry. And I literally saw him kind of backed up like, whoa, wait, hold on. That's not what I was expecting. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. We're just here on vacation. I didn't realize, you know, in the UK, we can walk across the road. And he was like, oh, ma'am, I'm so sorry. Well, just so that you know, like, don't do it again, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. And he said, you know, don't worry, have a good day, but just make sure you don't do it again. I was like, oh, thank you so much. Never address anything to my husband. But my husband was like, if I had opened my mouth, as in him, he said, guarantee that we would have got a ticket. Guaranteed.
So, Joanne, your husband is a Black American.
He's Black American, yeah.
Give me the real. Did you move for love or did you move for work?
I moved for love under the auspices of work.
Okay.
So it's funny, you know, when you were saying earlier on about the big deal about working for the BBC and all the rest of it. I'd worked for the BBC for a decade when I moved out here and I was working at Five Live. It was a really lovely situation. I really enjoyed working there, really great people. So when I left and I let people know, like, oh, hey, I'm moving to the States, I literally had people who I had not seen for quite some time. They were like, have you lost your entire mind? You're moving to America. What are you doing? And I'm like, you know, I'm going to be freelancing. I'm going to be doing some stuff for the BBC. I'm going to, you know, try my hand at doing some other things. And they were like, but you have a really good job. You're working at Five Live. Like, this is it. Like, your career goals. Like, why are you? And I'm like, you know, I don't see that I can actually move any further. I don't want to work in television. I really like this guy. So I'm going to go. I'm going to try it out. If it doesn't work, I'd still have my little flat. I'll come back. But people weren't having it. They were just like, she's lost it. But I've been here 14 years, so I guess it wasn't a bad decision after all.
Do you remember the process you went through to get to the US?
So a full disclosure, like, this is not what most people experience. So I came out to the US in May 2007, and I met up with some folks at the BBC Bureau. They were really great. They were like, well, you know, we always have work. If you end up out here, come through. If we've got stuff, you'll be good. But the other thing I did while I was out here that time, I love to visit radio stations wherever I go. And I went to one called KPFA, which is part of the Pacifica Network here in LA. And the person that I was meant to meet was actually out sick, but I don't know. I don't know why they weren't able to get in contact with me. But so I turned up and they were like, oh, you know, such and such isn't here, but actually you might want to go and have a look at the archives that are upstairs. So I was like, oh, okay, sure, no problem. So I went upstairs and they have the Pacifica Radio Archives, which is one of the oldest public radio collections in the US. Got talking to the folks there, and it's literally a vault full of tapes going back 60, actually probably almost like 70, 75 years at this point. And in that meeting, I was like, I think I have an idea for a show, because I was like, I'd love to share all this material with folks in the UK. Like, this is amazing. And it's folks from the civil rights era and musicians and artists and like all kind, like sports personalities, all sorts. And so I talked with the folks at Pacifica about it, and they were like, oh my gosh, we love that idea. I went back to one of my colleagues at Five Live, who was the editor of Up All Night. And I was like, I think there could be this thing. And he was like, well, if you end up going, we'll commission like a 30-minute segment every week. You pick whatever you want to do. We'll pay you a couple hundred quid for it or whatever. How's that sound? I was like, that sounds good. And he was like, oh, and I'll do your visa for you, because you'll be doing work. You'll be doing work for the BBC, and then we can have you do other things. So I actually came out of here on a journalism visa, and I had that probably for about a year. Me and my husband, we got married, and then I got my US green card that way. So my process was actually really straightforward and simple. So I knew I was coming out here with a job, and I didn't have to worry about all of the immigration stuff. But I, again, 100% recognize that's not usually how it happens for most people. I was very fortunate in that respect.
So when you arrived in the US as an established woman from the UK, did you find the transition easy? Were there any things that you found challenging that would have been easier for you in the UK?
You know, you take having a phone for granted. It's like, oh, I just have a phone. I've got my phone. I can do whatever with my phone. And coming out here, I didn't have any credit. I was in my 30s when I came out here. So, you know, I'd bought a house, I'd done all kinds of stuff. But coming out here, it was like I was 16 again, 18 again. Everything I had was like literally the money that I had or kind of credit cards that I had, but I didn't exist in the States. So having to build credit from scratch with the phone situation, like I had to get a pay-as-you-go phone, which was a nightmare if I was doing stories and I had to file in the field, because it would charge you for every minute that you're talking, or if people called you, you would be in charge for that as well. So I didn't love that. and then just like reestablishing credit, finding a hairdresser. And it was, I remember I came out here, like, you know, I was doing some television, and it was the year that it was like the final Harry Potter book came out, The Deathly Hallows. And it was, you know, big thing out here. And I got a call from the Beeb, and they were like, oh, you know, would you be able to go and cover it for us? I was like, yeah, of course. But I kind of remember looking at my head and being like, wait.
Yes.
So, you know, you get on Google and it's like, all right. And I have natural hair, you know, and it was really long back then. And I literally was wearing it kind of in cornrows and twists that I could get done down the street from my house in Tottenham for like 35 quid. No big deal. Came out here and I'm like, it's one of my assumptions. Like, oh, well, it's LA. There's a lot of black people here. There's a lot of black women here. There's Hollywood here. Oh, it's going to be really easy to get my hair done. Not so. So I found this one place. I made an appointment. I went. It was like an absolute horror show getting my hair done. And this was like a black hair salon that specialized in natural hair care. But I was like, okay, whatever. Like, let me just get it done. And it's finished. And of course, I hadn't asked about how much it cost because I'm like, well, it was £35 back in the UK. Like, it cannot be that expensive. So I get to the front and I was like, oh, how much? And she's like, oh, it's $200. And I looked at her. I was like, really?
Do you think she exploited the fact that you were British and you had a British accent?
100%. Because there were no kind of prices up. But the reason why I know that she was trying it on is that there were two people that worked on my hair. But the guy who'd worked on my hair, he slipped me his number and he was like, when you need your hair done again, call me. And when he did it, it was $80. Which was probably still a little bit more than regular folk were paying. But I was like, okay. So that put me on my guard that not everyone welcomes the accent. And that people, sure. And it's just a very easy way for you to be targeted. So suffice to say, I never went back there again. And I used that guy and paid the $80 and it was very lovely.
You know, in terms of the cost of living and things, I'd always assumed that living in the US would be more affordable. As you visit, you think, oh yeah, the pound, the sterling is so strong. I'm going to get my money's worth. And then you arrive here and I'm like, oh, how much for an avocado? Are you serious? Asparagus costs how much?
Yeah. It's really expensive out here. And you're right. I think as Brits, we're really spoiled when we're coming with our pound. And like, even when the exchange rate isn't great, you still feel like you're getting a little extra, a little something. And I actually remember before my husband and I got married, he came to the UK to visit me. And this is in the days of like when you would get like $2 to the pound, which is great for us. But when you're coming back the other way, it's like, oh, I'm going to give you my $2 and I'm going to get this one little coin. And so it worked out that, I don't know, a cup of tea was like $4 or something. And he's like, this is outrageous. So I did, when I first came, I kind of felt like, oh, okay. I was still earning money in pounds before like everything was set up. I was like, oh, okay, so I'm good. But then when I started earning in dollars and we were, you know, planning a trip back to the UK or, yeah, you're just kind of living regular life. And it's like the cost of like petrol was cheaper then, but food wasn't. You know, kind of things that we take for granted were definitely more expensive. I always thought that getting your nails done in the US was cheaper. Not really. It was
not at all.
Not at all. Like when I started living American life, I was like, man, this is just as expensive as living back in the UK. And then especially for somewhere like LA, you know, you're then getting into the cost of housing, which is on a par with or more expensive than London. You know, you get a bit more space for your money. If that's one thing I regret, it's just like moving from one really expensive city to another really expensive city, you know?
Sure.
It's just kind of like, oh, I didn't win there, but...
You have been here for 14 long years. 14 good years, may I ask, or...?
Yeah, for the most part, I think those first years... So remember, I moved here in 2007... The recession was 2008, 2009, and those years were tough because you're in a new place, you're trying to establish yourself. You know, your reputation back home doesn't mean anything out here. I really enjoyed freelancing, but there was a point where I was like, I would really love to just have a job with some security, but that wasn't afforded to me. And it wasn't a race thing at all. It literally was just like nowhere was hiring, or the places that were, it was more entry-level jobs. And so, you know, I really had to humble myself in that respect and kind of say, well, okay, this job at $25 an hour is better than no job at all. But I didn't mind that because in my mind, and I say this to anyone who's moving here, whether you're in, you know, in journalism, entertainment, like whatever industry you're in, the US and the UK share a language, but our cultures are different and the work cultures even are different. And so taking what you may feel are a couple of steps back actually really is beneficial to you in the end because you get to learn a new system kind of at much lower stakes. Like how people speak, how to negotiate. Like I'd never negotiated for a salary in my life. And it's only in recent years that I was like, oh, I should negotiate. Oh, because my American friends would be like, you didn't negotiate? And I'm like, no, well, you know, the salary was fine enough. And they're like, girl, what's wrong with you? But we don't do that in the UK. No. It's kind of like, this is the salary. Here are the benefits, if you get any at all. And kind of off you go. So I'm grateful that I had that time to kind of step back and learn a new public media system and a new way of doing things. So now I'm in a place where I'm able to take my years of experience here and my years of experience in the BBC. And then folks are kind of like, oh, wow, like you've done a lot. And I always kind of joke, I feel like I speak two languages. I speak British and I speak American. And there's a real benefit in that.
Sure. I was going to disagree with you earlier when you said we share the same language, but we have different cultures. But you've just said that actually you speak American and you speak, you know, British in a sense. Hubby and I, we've been having some run-ins over use of language like queue and line, yes. Garage, garage, rubbish.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had any of those nuances with your hubby at all?
Yeah, so I think one, actually very recently, so you know, not with hubby, but actually with some other American friends. So, you know, now the bum bag is back or whatever they call it. And I remember
fanny pack.
The fanny pack. And I remember the first time I heard that, it's like, oh my God, you're wearing a fanny. And I was like, what? It's like, yeah. And they looked at me like, what's the problem? And I was like, okay, so in British, it means this. And they were like, oh.
Quick disclaimer, fanny, a.k.a. vagina.
So I just call it a pouch, just to...
A pouch?
A pouch, which I don't know is any better. But, you know, just try and get around those things. But, you know, it's funny when you kind of talk about the hubby. I think what's interesting is like the rules around dating and what it means to date as a Brit. Because I feel like, and this may also just be like me and my really like tragic love life when I was back in the UK, but I didn't really date people. There wasn't a lot of dating that went on. It was kind of either you were with someone or you weren't. Whereas out here, it's very much more, hey, we're going to have coffee. Let's have dinner. Let's just maybe just kind of see where it goes. And if it goes somewhere, cool. But you can be dating multiple people at one time. And I'm kind of like, I don't know any of my friends back in the UK that would tolerate that. But it's kind of just what you do out here. So that's interesting.
That's almost like another show because there are so many perceptions about Black American men who date Black British women. And, you know, I'd heard things about Black American men from Black American women, and that was definitely not my experience. My experience was, you know, wonderful, hence why I'm married now.
Right.
But equally, I think I've heard Black American men speak very favorably about Black American women. So it was that wife swap kind of thing going on.
I don't know. Because like I asked my husband, I'm like, so kind of what was the attraction for you? And he was like, I just thought that you were cool and you just thought differently. But he said, if you were exactly the same person you are, but American, I'd feel the same way. Sure. You know, so the Britishness doesn't really factor in as such. But my voice was the first thing that he noticed because he was like, oh, okay, like this is Black woman in front of me, cool. And then he's like, oh, and you're British. And that, you know, kind of like started the conversation. So, you know.
You've been here a while, you're settled, but are there times where you feel very British in America?
Yeah, I think so. I think, honestly, anytime I open my mouth in a group of...
Yeah, because you still sound English, mate.
Still sound proper English, isn't it? But it's like, you know, but a lot of my friends here, like my close friend here is British. I still hang out with British people. You know, I talk to my family a lot. So that I think that kind of that keeps the accent fresh. I tell you what, I do find myself sometimes when, because as soon as you do open your mouth and you say anything and people are like, oh my gosh, you're British. And there's that curiosity factor. And then everyone wants to talk to you. And sometimes I'm like, I don't want to talk to people. So I just won't say anything. And so people will say to my husband, like, oh my gosh, your wife is so quiet. And he's like, no, she's not. She just doesn't want to talk to anybody today. Because it's just, it's never a quick conversation. You're always going to get into, well, why did you come? And what do you do? And da, 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 da. And some days it's just kind of like, so you're from England, but where are you from? Which is that's a whole other podcast, you know?
So do you get that here? Because I haven't found that so much. I mean, if I meet a Black American, they'll ask me, where are you from? And I'll say the UK or London, and that will be enough. They won't ask any other questions. Whereas, you know, I've said this before, I don't know any Black British people, full stop. They are Black British Bayesian. They are Black British Ghanaian. They are Black British something else. Whereas here, people are quite comfortable with saying, I am Black American, the end, the beginning and the end. So I'm surprised that you're getting that here.
I do. And I think partly it may just be a consequence of where I am. Like, there's a lot of folks from Belize here in LA. There's a lot of Jamaican folks, a lot of Trinidadians actually here in LA. So I think sometimes there is just when they hear the accent, it's kind of like, oh, okay, you're British. But I think there is an understanding of, oh, Britain probably was not the first stop, if you know what I mean. So then sure. I'm kind of like, oh no, I'm from Barbados. And every hurricane season, it's then kind of like, oh, is your island okay? No, that's Bahamas. Is your island? No, that's Bermuda. Oh, okay. all the bees kind of roll into one. But you know, I do think standing out has helped. And I do think that moving out here, I think, has made me a much stronger person. It's made me question a lot of things. You know, there was a lot of ways that I was treated, be it at work or dating or not dating or at school, where I just accepted a lot of things. It was kind of like, well, I should be grateful for what I have. I should be grateful that I get to do this work. When really it was kind of like, you know, I had no expectation that I could have more. And moving out here just really made me realize your limitations are yourself. What do you want to do with this? And also when you move out of your little kind of circle of comfort, not that you're reimagining who you are, you're not becoming a new person, like you're always going to be the essence of who you are, but I think you are forced to examine what your boundaries are or just how far you can push yourself. It just brings up all other kinds of questions that when you have safety, that perhaps you don't question, you just kind of do it.
So how would you describe your cultural identity to others now?
I say that I'm a Black British Bayesian. Barbados is always, that's the foundation of who I am, like my ancestry, my home. But Britain is also home. That's where I grew up, that's where I was born. But then America is home. So sometimes it's this, and especially with the pandemic, it's been this very soupy feeling of what does it mean to go home? Because in my head, I'm just sure. Like, I just want to go home. And it's kind of like, when you say that, what do you mean? I think really what I mean is I want to go to where my family is, and that's where they are. They're in Barbados and they're in the UK. But I love the complexity of my identity because no one can put you in a box. No one can say, oh, well, that's how you Brits are. And it's kind of like, yeah, but I'm from Barbados too, though. Oh, that's how you Bayesians are. It's like, yeah, but I live in LA. Oh, like no one can do that to you. And my life just feels so much richer for being able to call all of these places home.
That's amazing. Very inspiring. I'm going to ask you some really fast questions now.
Do it.
Yeah. Let me in. What's your favorite UK meal versus your favorite meal in the States?
Oh, I think it's got to be fish and chips. No offense to any kind of fish and chip place that I've been to in the US, but it's just not, it's not the same. Fish and chips in the UK with curry sauce, hands down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know, okay. Right? Versus...
Do you have mushy peas on the side?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
You're not that British then.
No. But it tastes really good. Now, if it's your favourite Caribbean meal.
I didn't ask you that. I asked you what's your favourite British meal.
Fine. Fish and chips it is then. Fish and chips. Curry sauce. Favourite US meal. I know you can get it in the UK, but sushi. Like, I didn't eat sushi. What? And yeah, I didn't eat sushi until my first trip to the States when I was, what, like 25 or whatever. And I feel like I've had sushi back in the UK and I'm like, nah, that's not it.
It's not the same.
Nah.
Okay. What comes in your suitcase with you when you're going to the UK or when you're coming back to the US?
Oh, going to the UK, it's usually a bunch of hair products for my sisters with stuff that they can't get in the UK. And also Trader Joe's almond, cranberry, and what is it? Almond, cranberry, and whatever. But they're nut mix.
Sounds very posh.
I'm like, you people can get these in the UK. And my family are like, no, the Trader Joe's mix is like, it's the one. Bring it. Like, fine. What am I bringing back from the UK? Jaffa cakes.
No way.
Yes. And wine gums, because the imported ones don't taste the same here. And PG tips.
Yes, tea is a must. It's really strange though. My husband hates tea and he can't stand the smell of it. And I brought back like a massive box of tea and he's double bagged it. He's just like, I just can't take the smell.
Wow.
Best thing about living in the US?
The weather.
What do you miss most about the UK?
My family.
Not who.
Oh,
no. Not who.
Okay.
Not who. I knew you were going to go there.
I think, you know, like walking around London, like the architecture of London and the history, you can't beat it. Like going into art galleries, even this is going to sound weird, like even the smell, there's something about kind of like the UK air that's just like crisp and fresh and clean, like even in the dirtiest of places, like missing, wrapping up in a coat, wearing a scarf, putting on a hat, putting on gloves and just like going outside.
You can get that here, surely. There's so many states to visit.
Yeah, but on a day-to-day at home in LA, it's a bit grey today, but most days it's warm and it never gets cold enough to really wrap up. My husband actually used to make fun of me when, like, the first year, I moved here in the July, and so it was, like, that first autumn, so October, November. Like, I love blazers and jackets, and I'd bought these blazers and jackets and scarves, and it was October, so, and it was a cool day, and I was like, oh, okay, so it's time to, like, for me to bust out all my cool weather stuff. And I put it on and went outside, and I was sweating, because it was just hot. And he was like, where do you think you are? And I'm like, yeah, but it's October, and it was cool this morning. He's like, you can give all of that stuff away. You're not going to wear it. But I still have a couple of UK issue jackets for when I go home, just in case.
Have you ever considered moving back home?
Yes.
When and why? And is that still a consideration?
Not a consideration anymore. But we talked about it really seriously when our son was born. It was really about, I realised how far I was away from my family. I also felt really sad knowing that my family wouldn't know my son as well as I know my nieces and nephews. And I was really sad, really sad about that. And like, we have a good life here, you know, and we've just had to be really intentional of finding other ways to maintain that connection, especially with his grandparents. But that was when it was most intense, was that probably like year and a half after he was born.
And so your son is, you know, what would you consider him? Do you think your British influence has been heavy on him?
It's funny, when he was young, so I was home for a couple of years with him up until he was two, and he would say mummy and water, and like he would say things in a very British way. And he went to preschool and it was a wrap after about a week. I was like, can I have some water? And I'm like, water? Would you like some water? And he was looking at me like, chill out, lady. Like, this is how I speak. He understands that he has many homes and that he has choices. Like, when he's older, he knows, like, if you want to go and live in England, you can. If you want to go and live in Barbados, you can. If you want to stay here, you can. And I don't know, like I'm excited to kind of see how he will move in the world as a Black American man, knowing that he has choices just by virtue of who his mum is.
That's so heartwarming and definitely resonates with me. You're up to some really interesting things, some things that you weren't able to share with me, but I want to know, what can we expect to see from yourself in the coming months, years?
Yeah, actually, I'll be able to tell you this. So I just very recently took on a new role as a chief content officer with APM Studios. So I am heading up their content.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm heading up their content strategy. I'm really thinking about like how we serve audiences, not just here in the US, but also overseas. How do we bring in different producers? How do we tell different stories? And, you know, I know a big part of the draw for them was the experience that I've had elsewhere. Like, I don't just think about the audience here. I don't just understand the audience in the US. I also understand what it means to be an audience member in the UK or in the Caribbean, or, you know, kind of through my friends who are from West Africa and East Africa. So I really take being a global citizen seriously. And I really see that there's so much more that connects us than divides us. And I feel, again, like so fortunate that I'm able to take my good experiences and my not so great experiences and be able to not just make a mark in the UK, but also make a mark out here in the US.
That's so exciting. And I feel even more privileged to have connected with you. And I'm like, right, I need to know where to start when I get here. And I got it sorted because I know Joanne. Joanne, how can our listeners connect with you?
Twitter is probably the best place. I'm at Global Journo. I'm GlobalJourno, Global Journo. Or you can also go to my website, joannegriffith.net. Griffith, no S on the end, joannegriffith.net.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And, you know, as I said, I'm delighted that you were one of the first people who I really had a heart to heart with about doing the whole crossover thing. And you've very much helped me set up. So thank you, Joanne.
Oh, it's like, you know, I say this to everyone, like if you have an inkling that you want to do something, do it, try it. Like if the pandemic has taught us nothing, is that life can be brief and short. Like make every moment count. And if it feels intimidating to move to a new place, like ask people who have done it. Listen to this podcast. You know, you'll get a lot of information here. Everything seems scary until you do it. And then you do it and it's like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Okay, now what am I going to do next? Live the adventure. Just do it.
Amazing advice. Thank you so much, Joanne.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Amazing advice from Joanne Griffith, who shared some similarities between her experiences in the UK and US. Some of her frustrations really hitting home for me personally. But for me, the key takeaway in Joanne's story was that she gave up what was seemingly good in the UK and ended up with even better in the US. A gentle reminder, perhaps, that sometimes you just have to let go and trust that something better is around the corner or across the ocean. Plus, growth doesn't happen in your comfort zone and not always in your time zone. To share your experience of being Black in the UK versus the US, email us directly at AmericanDreamersPodcast@gmail.com. And please rate and review American Dreamers on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way for people to find this podcast. Special thanks to Aura Studios, our assistant producer, Brianna Jovan, and editor, David Devereaux. Stay in touch with me on the socials throughout the week at Claire Clottie.